Okay. So I'm a couple minutes early, but we can use the time to meditate, to try to set a good set a good motivation and to quiet our minds. So we have an expert meditator with us tonight, Samatha. I was trying to remember before because I was thinking, was it Burma or Thailand? But he's from Sri Lanka, right? You're from Sri Lanka, right? So let's sit comfortably, relax your body, relax your mind. And as it says in many of the Buddhist sutras, after the Buddha had gone around for his morning bindaba, his morning alms round, he washed his feet, sat down, and placed his mindfulness on the breathing in front. So we're going to do the same. Excuse me. Without controlling, just watch your breathing with that added wisdom factor of recognizing when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out, and analyzing the very endpoints when it changes direction. In so doing, let go of all other thoughts. Maybe at first you forget the object, the breathing. You're just wandering onto other thoughts. But once you find it, try to hold on to it tightly. as your breathing has become a little bit calmer and your mind less prone to be following the thoughts, follow one inhalation. Again, just observing. Don't control it. Don't make larger breath. Imagine breathing up to the crown of your head, to your throat, to your heart, and leave your attention there. Let go of watching the breathing, and instead observe the mental primary consciousness, the clear and knowing nature of the mind. It's not as though you, an arbitrary observer, the self or something, is observing, but one part of the mind dedicated to watching the rest of the mind. Sometimes the texts say, try to observe the unfabricated nature of your mind. That means not something that you're just making up right now or you're imagining that nature to be. But try to observe it. There's clarity between the thoughts. They've already begun to subside a little bit. And when the thoughts, because of not paying attention to them, begin to diminish, disappear, it's as though they're absorbing back into the clear light nature of your mind. They themselves have the same nature, even though they seem as objects at first within the clarity of our mind. Let go of the thoughts. Let go even of your imagination of the mind and try to perceive something vaster, more authentic, the actual mind within which even the mental image we build up of the mind, that's all embedded in that consciousness, that clear light nature. Here, even the distractions are your friend in that they remind you that this nature of the mind has this particular quality of being unobstructing. The thoughts or distractions arise out of that clear light nature and they dissolve back into it. That's what you're trying to observe, this unimpeded, clear quality of the mind that can arise in the aspect of whatever is presented to it, like a mirror. let go of the appearance of your body as though you're sitting there, a meditator. That's being perceived by your tactile consciousness, body consciousness, and intercepted by the mental consciousness, watched by the mental consciousness. It's appearing to your mental consciousness as an image, because you don't have a continuous direct perception of it. You have sort of a mental image of it. That too is another thought, distraction within your mind. Let go of that and perceive the consciousness that is perceiving that body, or you can say within which that body is appearing. Keep your mind alert. If it just starts to feel sluggish and not have any particular understanding of what it's apprehending, go back to remind yourself you're looking at the clear light nature, vast space-like nature of our mind within which all these thoughts, images arise, and within which they dissolve back into. Then see if you can observe the appearance to your mind of yourself, myself. Don't identify with your body, the I. Sometimes we do, but we've recognized the body appearance is just that, an appearance to the mind. We've let go of that. But a sense of I, such that the I seems to be under its own power, not in any way dependent on anything else, just there, existing from its own side. If you have fear or you've been criticized, try to remember that. Some kind of dynamic emotion like that, or strong desire for something. I want that so much. The I can become more clear now because we've tried to calm the mind, first by watching the breathing, then by watching the nature of the consciousness. Sometimes a sense of I might be more prominent. Sometimes it might fade a little bit, as though absorbing back into the clear light nature of your mind. this sense of I is what instigates our anger, our attachment, our jealousy, our depression, our low self-esteem. The appearance of this I and the belief in it Lord Buddha told us that since beginningless time till now, we've observed this I in different forms when we were animals or hell beings or gods or humans. We had a perception of our self-identity that did not accord with reality. And under the influence of wanting to protect it, to cherish it, we developed attachment, anger, hatred, all of the delusions, created negative karma that has kept us in unhappiness and suffering. Take to mind if you've ever had a big disappointment in life, a defeat, or someone left you. Recognize how the feeling about that depends on the existence of this I, the seeming existence of this I. Buddha said, this I has never existed the way that it's appearing. There was no I who was left. There was no I who was shamed. There was no I like this who created negative karma, that we might feel ashamed of. Now the clarity of the mind is still there. Now try to recognize that clarity as you let go of your belief in this I. Let it as though dissolve back into that clarity of the mind. Try to recognize that clarity as having the significance of being empty of an inherently existing I. And think this liberating experience, recognizing eventually, now we're just doing a simulation, so to speak, of meditation on emptiness. We haven't applied real logic, real reasoning. We haven't developed an inferential cognizer. Just with some faith that the Buddha said this I does not exist the way that it appears, very liberating to think, I'm okay. This has come about because we were born as a human being right now with the freedom from the 8 unfree states and endowed with the 10 richnesses that the Buddha talked about so often, being born as a human when the Dharma teachings existed and so forth. So as not to waste this opportunity, knowing what I can do with it in meditation, to develop this incredible confidence and freedom, I'm going to listen to the teachings tonight with that initial thought to first heal myself, to heal myself out of the sickness of cyclic existence, to escape to nirvana. But beyond that, all the living beings, numberless beings, are continuing to suffer, not recognizing this Buddha nature, this clear light nature of the mind, and feeling some responsibility toward them, affection for them, for they've nurtured us as mothers numberless times, and with their friendship and camaraderie in numberless lives, our best friends. And even when they were enemies, they helped us purify our negative karma in that life. Think for their welfare, I'm going to forego the thought to enter into personal nirvana and instead work for the welfare of all sentient beings as the Bodhisattva, Siddhartha, eventually the Buddha. Make a strong motivation. Tonight I'm going to listen to the teachings, participate, use my wisdom to analyze the teachings, contemplate them, meditate on it, with the thought to eventually attain enlightenment for myself as the best way to help sentient beings. I'm going to listen to the teachings in order to become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. And then bring your attention back to the present. Someday we have to put the microphone in front of Joy, right? So you can hear her. Microphone for you. I'm just teasing. She sometimes cracks her knuckles, and I can hear because she's very close. Right? I'm just teasing her. So, how was your meditation? Any observation? Yes. Yes. Good chin brings.
Hi, Venerable. Definitely the mind is a source of lots of our affliction. But I'm going to ask today is about if you're feeling physically unwell, that part interferes a lot with my ability to meditate. So for example, I'm having this low-grade headache.
Say again?
A low-grade headache. I have a headache. It's a physical unwellness.
Low-grade?
Low-grade means there's this troubling headache.
Oh, headache.
Headache.
You said you hated low-grade. I said, oh.
Yeah, sorry.
I said, no. I was just teasing. That was the subject we were studying. I thought you said you were making it.
So, when we're physically unwell, it interferes with my mental states. I'm not quite sure exactly it's not, it may or may not be a mental projection. So physically unwell, so let's say if I'm, as I said, I'm having a headache and it interferes. Yeah. So very, what can I do?
Yeah, so very good observation. So for instance, if just being a little bit ill now, having imbalance of the elements or having pain in the body or being bothered by mosquito or whatever else, if that can distract us from meditation, imagine what it's like if we're born as an animal. You know, fearful always of predators wanting to eat us, kill us, looking for food all the time, not being able to alleviate the suffering. We know that when a dog is suffering, it doesn't know to go and get the Band-Aid or to take an aspirin or something. It just sort of lies there, and we can see it might be suffering, other animals. If we were born as a hungry ghost, never having a moment to meditate because constantly worried to find even a drop of water, you know, food, like like the kind of... Sometimes we have that kind of strong preta. Preta is the Indian word, right? Sanskrit word that means hungry ghost. So this strong preta mind, almost like, I want to find friendship, I want to find success. You know, it's almost as though you're walking the streets at night, going from one club, one coffee house to another, or one disco to another, looking for friendship, like the preta we experience that mind. No time to really meditate. Or the hell beings, totally suffering. So very good observation. So if right now, even with this body, with a little bit of suffering, it's hard to control the mind, what's it going to be like later? So that can give us some energy to try to investigate this. So one thing I've noticed also, sometime when I've been really sick, I had in India when I was at the monastery, hepatitis. I drank some lassi. You know what lassi is? Or you say lassi, lassi? Well, lassi is the dog. Lassi on the Indian train that wasn't refrigerated, and I got the lesser hepatitis, you know, where you get jaundice and everything. And I remember at that time, very difficult to control my mind. And I thought, wow, if it's so difficult now, what's it going to be like at the time of death? Because at the time of death, there's fear, the elements are absorbing, you may have some pain, may or may not, but it's quite possible you have pain, but certainly fear arises in the mind. At that point, how are you going to control the mind? So this can give us the energy to go beyond that, to even when the pain is there, as in, you know, famously, in the, when we do just beginning watching the breathing and watching the feelings, to go beyond identifying with the feelings. Today, I had a chance to get my teeth. You know, every 6 months you're supposed to have your teeth cleaned. You know, they had this just going in your mouth. Even just thinking about it, she's getting nervous, and. I used to, when I would go to the dentist to have a cavity, I used to, when I was a kid, they'd always give Novocaine. But at a certain point, I realized I would forego that. And even though there was some pain, I would just try to meditate. And I found, I never, for many years, I didn't have. Now I'm getting older. If given the chance, I'll take the Novocaine. But what you can do is try to recognize you don't have to identify with the pain, if there is pain. Sometimes it's a little bit different, like the winds within the body, the chi or prana within the body is causing the mind to be disturbed. So even then, if you watch with this kind of meditation, watch the mental consciousness and recognize all of that is happening in... The way that you know that is happening is because it appears to your mind. You know, somehow you have a feeling there's, you know, something going on in the body, the pain or whatever, heat, cold, all of that is appearing within the spaciousness of your mind. And just in one instant, remembering this meditation, you can let go of observing the object and following it and feeling, ooh, this is not good. Just let go. Don't identify with it. And just watch the nature of the mind within which that's appearing. As you don't follow those thoughts, you know, the thought that, oh, something's wrong, I'm pain, you know, something's happening. As you don't follow them, they're deprived of the energy that sustains them. Because thoughts depend upon our attention to them to remain. Generally, if I ask you to think of the Buddha, you might think of it for a second and then your mind wanders. You're not able to perpetuate that. These other thoughts, negative thoughts, are the things we've learned to focus on and we're practiced in keeping them in mind, especially, you know, feeling pain and feeling sorry and feeling, you know, sorry for ourselves. So there's the mind is kind of tenacious to keep that in mind, whereas the mind is not as tenacious now. Do you know what I mean? But tenacious, you know, like having some, I gotta just keep that in mind. We don't have that same kind of a mind to keep the Buddha in mind, but we do have the concentration on the suffering and so forth. So just to let go of that, let go, and watch the spaciousness of your mind. Remember that this will pass. Remember when I talked about the antidotes the other night of, say, anger. You know, when something is uncomfortable that might cause us to get angry. When something is uncomfortable, that gives rise to this angered repulsion. You know, you may not call it anger, but there's some kind of uncomfortable feeling that wants to get rid of it. Craving to be free of that, you know, strong. So just to remind yourself that this will pass. That itself is, you don't focus so much on what's happening in your body or in your mind, the other thoughts, that tension begins to diminish. I remember at Kopan, the first meditation course I went to in 1974, wow, 45 years ago, seems like yesterday. I was doing some hatha yoga in the morning before the meditation, and during some of the meditation, we would be, say, breathing in white light and breathing out our delusions in the form of smoke and so forth. I felt this pain in my heart. And I was thinking, it continued on, and I was thinking, maybe this was due to there was some contradiction between doing hatha yoga in the morning and this maybe. So I made an appointment to see Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who was the teacher. And before that appointment came up, in one of his lectures, because, you know, he was busy, it was going to be a couple of days later, he was saying in the lecture, heart is the nature of fire. And I thought, because this was in my heart. And so I was, from my usual distracted state, you know, like some of you right now are paying attention, some of you are maybe thinking of the groceries or, you know, something else. So I paid it more attention. Heart is the nature of fire. And he said, while we're in cyclic existence, samsara, it's the nature of cyclic existence to be suffering. So if you feel like, you know, it's almost like our thought is that I shouldn't be feeling this. I shouldn't be feeling, because there's some days that I feel great. But this is the nature of cyclic existence. In fact, this is like a wake-up call sometime. And Rinpoche had said, if you can just let go of that, of your attention to that pain, that it can begin to diminish, just to recognize it'll pass. That was very helpful. And so in the subsequent meditations, tried to do that, and the pain went away. So I was telling, in the afternoons and the mornings, we would have coffee. It wasn't real coffee. It was soybean coffee. And so we were drinking around with the other students, and I said, oh, that was amazing. Rinpoche, I don't have to see him now. He answered my question in the lecture. And they said, oh, yeah, what did he say? What was the thing? And I said, remember when he said heart is the nature of fire? And they all looked at me like, what? He didn't say heart is the nature of fire. He said heat is the nature of fire. Sometimes we hear what we needed to hear. You know, otherwise I wouldn't have paid attention to that. If he said heat is the nature of fire, I would have continued being distracted or something. Yeah, heat is the nature of fire. So if you stick your hand in the fire, oblivious of the fact that it's hot, and you get burned, you know, people would say, you're silly. That's its nature. So it's the nature of samsara to be suffering. That's why we want to escape from it. And in our ordinary lives, when we make everything comfortable, we have the karma to protect ourselves from so many sufferings, to immediately satisfy every desire. Haagen-Dazs ice cream and pizza, Doritos, music on your phone, you know, everything. It's almost as though you forgot that this is the nature of cyclic existence. So think also that's your guru. You know, oh, this is waking me up. And make a strong resolution to try to continue to meditate through that pain, and as the body, and do whatever is necessary to alleviate the physical pain. If there's some medication or massage or something, a bath or something that you can do to alleviate the pain, of course. But then as you get a little bit clearer mind, calmer mind, that's not oppressed by that so much, try to recall that. Wow, what's it going to be like at the time of death? If just now there was a little imbalance in the elements, what is it going to be like at the time of death? I've got to be able to control my mind. The only way I can control my mind is through practice, through meditation. So that's my thought. Heart is the nature of fire. Okay. Someone else have a question they wanted to ask? Yes.
Thank you. I kind of had a question about karma while I was meditating. Because as I was letting go and getting into, like, I guess, more subtle mind, pretty soon it felt...
Yeah, hold a little... This one's... I think they turned up the volume, so hold it just a little further away from your mouth.
Okay. Yeah. So, can you hear me?
Now, halfway closer. There
okay.
You go. There you go. Find the middle way.
Okay. So, at some point, it felt very non-local, and I wondered, like, about...
Non-vocal or non-local?
Local. Non-local. Okay. So, like I felt like that me body that was there somewhere wasn't really, like, I wasn't that connected to it, and yet it was like, I thought, are there subtle levels that...
excuse me. So, I'm not sure why you said this is about karma, but I think sometimes we can have different physical... Oh, maybe you can take it and turn it off for a second. So sometimes we can have different physical bodily sensations that we can get caught up into. I remember once when I meditated for many years, when I had some good concentration, it seemed one half of my body this way, you know, vertically, would be hot, the other half would be cold. Palpably cold, you know, hot. And then over the course of 20 minutes, it would change. This side would be hot, and this side would be cold. And I remember coming to tell Lama Yeshe about this. And Lama was laughing. He was sitting on his bed, and he's laughing so hard he rolled over and fell on the floor. And he said, oh, there's so many physical and mental experiences that you can have when you try to meditate, especially if we haven't been doing this lifetime. You know, if it's relatively new for us. I mean, even if you might say you've done it for years, it's relatively new compared to samsara, beginningless lives. And so there are different kinds of experiences that can be, that you can have. And Lama's reminded us not to put a lot of importance in them. You know, you might try it in your next meditation. You might be afraid if that was a fearful experience. Is that going to happen again? Or you might try to duplicate it. Oh, I hope I can float out of the body again or something. Don't pay attention to those, because they will change over time. You know, my hot and cold body disappeared after some time. So not to pay a lot of attention to that. Okay. So let me continue on. So we talked last time about the 12 virtuous mental factors, right? Okay, good. And Joyce, yeah, she's on her game today. The 11 virtuous mental factors. How many mental factors are there altogether in the Mahayana Abhidharma? Two mental factors, no? How many? 51. Huh? In the Pali Canon, how many? What do we say? Citta and Cittana. How many Cittana are there in the Pali Canon? Do you know? Did you have a chance to study the Abhidharma? How many? Yeah, how many? Well, cittas, what do we say, five or six, right? Five senses and the mental consciousness. How many cittana? The cittana. Ah, okay. So you're familiar with the exposition in the Mahayana Abhidharma. I think in some of the Abhidharma Kosha, which was talking about the Vaibhashika school, some of the old Theravada, there were different numbers, 48 and different numbers. But so you know what we're talking about. So we've gone through the five omnipresent mental factors, the five object ascertaining mental factors. Any sense consciousness or mental consciousness that is knowing an object will have all 10 of those present. If it's not knowing an object, the five omnipresent mental factors are always there. Then we talked about the 11 virtuous mental factors. That's how we're translating cetana, mental factors. And now we just briefly talked about this before, the root delusions, the root afflictions, the klesha. In Pali, how is it pronounced? It's not klesha. Right, that's Sanskrit. How do you say in Pali? Kalesha? Such as raga and mana and so forth, the klesha? Yeah. Yeah. What's the word for that in Pali? Klesha? Kalesha. Okay, so that's what I was saying. So in Pali, I was telling people before, in Sanskrit you have KL, klesha, but in Pali it's kalesha. So that you don't have two different consonants together in Pali. So it's interesting. So Venerable is familiar with this. So here we're talking about the division from the three divided into the famous six root delusions. So we talked about this before, but we're going to go into a little more detail now. So the first one is attachment, raga, or desire. Desire doesn't sound exactly right to me, because you can have desire for good things. You can desire to become Buddha. So this is a state of mind. Attachment is a state of mind that perceives something which, according to your karma, is perceived as pleasant, attractive or pleasant, and because of that, your mind has the tendency, if thinking about it in the wrong way, what we call inappropriate attention, begins to analyze it in a wrong way and think, oh, this has great qualities. If I had that, either the object or the situation, I'd be well off. I'd be fine. And so it's a mind that begins to exaggerate the qualities of the object or situation in a wrong way, and because of becoming even more and more sort of like interesting to your mind, the mind develops the desire to either obtain or to keep, because you can be attached to your own belongings. It's not as though you need to obtain them. We monks are taught, even our robes, we have supposed to be, nowadays we have maybe even cell phone, I have cell phone and computer, but maybe Venerable has less, but even our robes, there's a tradition in Tibetan that when you get a new robe, you pour some black ink on it so that it's a little bit spoiled and the initial attachment to it is sort of diminished. I'm not saying you should do that with your car. You shouldn't. You don't have to. You don't have to key your car or something just so you don't have as much attachment to it. Do you use that expression when someone is angry at you? They take their key and they. Yeah. I don't know if that happens here. Probably, hope not. Hopefully not. So, attachment is that mental factor, this delusion. Keshala or klesha that it superimposes qualities that it does not really have and develops an attraction to try to obtain that. So I'll read what Jeffrey says here, Jeffrey Hopkins. He says, desire, I'll say attachment, perceives an internal or external contaminated phenomenon. Remember what contaminated phenomenon meant? Contaminated phenomena meant something which has arisen because of contaminated karma and delusions. Say, for instance, from a Mahayana Abhidharma point of view, you couldn't have real attachment to the actual Buddha because the Buddha is not a contaminated phenomenon. But there's some debate about that. Remember, in some of the schools, they say that an arhat, after attaining nirvana, still before they pass away, their body is still a contaminated phenomena. So they, the general arhat. But the Buddha's body, from the Mahayana point of view, is something different. It's arisen not because of contaminated karma. So attachment perceives an internal or external contaminated phenomena to be pleasant from the point of view of its own entity. It's, like that's it from its own side. It's not just my projection upon it. We're thinking it's really there from its own side, and thereupon seeks it, wants to get it or to keep it. It has the function of generating suffering. So he gives the example, like oil that has set in cloth, sort of absorbed into cloth, like the example I gave of being at the restaurant. If the waiter were to knock over the salt shaker, or if you were to knock over the salt shaker with a little brush, you can get rid of the salt very easily from the tablecloth. It looks pristine again. But if you knock over the olive oil, it sinks into the cloth. You can't just brush it off. So, like oil that is set in cloth, attachment adheres to its object of observation and thus is difficult to separate from it. Yeah, you can notice that. I think that's when we talk about having a broken heart. Do you ever use that expression? Broken heart. Someone, you broke my heart when I loved you so much, you left me or something. It's almost as though your heart is broken because of attachment. Our mind is though sank into the object, and if the object is taken away, it's almost like it's almost like pulling out from your heart. So, as I mentioned in one of the other courses also, between attachment and anger. Anger is more destructive immediately, but actually it's like the salt. Because the aspect that you're perceiving is not pleasant, you can more easily have the courage to apply the antidotes and get rid of anger. The antidotes can work more quickly. Remember we talked about antidotes, remedies to anger? But attachment, because it sinks into the object and it's something that's attractive, you don't even have the interest to apply the antidotes at first. You have to really remember again and again that the object of your attachment is of the nature of suffering. It's difficult to separate it from it. So one way of dividing desire is desire of the, or attachment of the desire realm, this realm that we live in, which we share with the animals and the preta, hundred ghosts, the hell beings, are all desire realm. Some of the gods, up through Indra, of the desire realm gods, are also desire realm. So that state of that, there's that kind of attachment. There's a subtler kind of attachment of the form realm. So if you were to develop, as we talked about in the course, if you were to develop samatha, shamatha, how's it pronounced in Pali? Samatha? Samatha. If you were to develop samatha, you actually have a preparation, even before you develop, even before you try to go to the first form realm absorption, you have a mind of the form realm separated from attachment. And there's a subtler kind of attachment there in the form realm. So it's not that you have to go there. You have a mind of the form realm. And there's a subtler kind of attachment. The attachment that we have in the desire realm is more gross. There's also even a subtler attachment of the formless realm. Then Jeffrey says, the reason for stating that the function of attachment is to generate suffering is that the root of all suffering is birth. And the main cause of birth in cyclic existence is attachment, or we say trisna in Pali? Tanha. So you know both. Okay, excellent. So it's interesting. Tanha, you may have heard. So it actually, of the 12 links of dependent origination, we have tanha or trisna, craving, grasping, becoming. So those are those two, thirst or craving and grasping, intensify the karmic imprints on our mind at the time of death, and they are what activates a karmic seed to impel us into a future rebirth. So that's why it's saying here that it says the reason for stating that the function of desire or attachment is the generation of suffering, the reason is that the root of all suffering is birth. How does birth come about? The main cause of birth in cyclic existence is this thirst, this particular kind of attachment. So it's something that we want to try to eliminate. Yeah. So second of the root delusions, root klesha, is anger. Anger is a state of mind, it generates just sort of opposite to attachment. It perceives something which is unpleasant. Say the mind perceives, so the generation of it comes about like this. We perceive something unpleasant, either another person's words or their harm or the sky raining on us or our own ineptitude. And we begin to exaggerate the faults of that. The same way that attachment exaggerated the qualities of the thing that we liked, anger exaggerates the faults of something and really thinks those faults adhere in the object or situation from their own side. And we get to the point where instead of seeking that object, like attachment sought, wants to seek the object that's pleasant, anger has an opposite kind of thing, wanting to be free of it. So I'll read you this definition. Anger is an intention to harm sentient beings, to harm sufferings in one's own continuum. Yeah, you know, almost like you're getting angry at the suffering in your own continuum, or to harm phenomena that are sources of suffering, such as the bee bites or thorns or something like that. It has the function of causing oneself not to remain in contact with happiness and serves as a basis for misconduct. Through anger, one does not abide in happiness in this lifetime, and immeasurable suffering is induced in the future. So we mentioned between the two, attachment in its various forms, including tanha, trisna, so forth. Between that and anger is the more destructive, because not only does it create a negative karma when we get angry, but by its very nature, it burns up the virtuous karma that we've accumulated. Like you remember Rinpoche's teaching, heart is the nature of fire. Heat is the nature of fire. So like that, we sometimes say that anger is like a fire. When it's present in your consciousness, it has a similar function to fire burning. And for instance, I've mentioned several times in this and in the other courses, if you were to take some potent seeds, by potent I mean still good, fertile seeds to grow, durian or something, you know, spinach or rice, and you put them on a sheet and in the oven at, say, 265 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple of hours, they might come out looking almost the same. You don't put it up to 400 or something, just enough. But if you were to plant those seeds, either they would not grow at all, or there would be some little bleep, you know, some little thing that would fall over, you know, wouldn't be a viable sprout. Like that, the virtuous seeds on our continuum, the virtuous karmic seeds, are affected by anger so that they lose their potency, or they're delayed in when they will ripen. They might, something that might have ripened even this lifetime, supporting our realizations, might be put off for many eons. Or in the extreme case of anger, it burns up the seed's potency completely. So although there's still some obstruction in our mind, the seed is still there, it won't have the possibility of bringing a virtuous result, a happy result in the future. So anger is like a double whammy. It's an American expression. Whack, whack. You get hit both sides. You burn up negative karma. I mean, you create negative karma and you burn up virtuous karma. Unlike attachment, the main function of attachment is, you know, that what it does in terms of that, in terms of karma, is to create negative karma. Attachment is also much more difficult to get rid of, like the example of the oil in the cloth. So both of those delusions, both of these klesha, have some special feature. Between the two, what do you think is the most dangerous? If I said destructive, you'd have to say anger. But if I just said dangerous, what would you say? Why? Yeah, so make you happy. The way you put it, I think you must have a little dog. Do you have a little dog? If you love it, what? I think you're right, but maybe not for the reason you're thinking. Maybe for the reason you're thinking. Usually we say that because attachment has the aspect of wanting to, you know, it has the aspect of experience something pleasant and wanting to get it, it's very difficult to remove from the mind. So the main obstacle in the Theravada tradition is this tanha or trishna, this particular kind of attachment that instigates the ripening of our karmic seeds at the time of death. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, the main of these two, anger is the main obstacle, because the point is not immediately to get out of cyclic existence, but to develop compassion for sentient beings. And anger is a main obstacle to developing that compassion. Okay, so we talked attachment, anger. Then third one, pride. So the definition of pride will use the name of one of the other of the delusions. Remember I said there were, if we say there's six root delusions, right? One of them, the last one is called what? Wrong view? No. It's called deluded view, because if you expand deluded view, there are five kind of deluded views, one of which is called wrong view. But the whole category is just called deluded view or afflicted views. Okay, one of those views is called the view of the transitory collection. So I have to go to that first to explain about pride. What is the view of the transitory collection? From some point of view, this is the root of cyclic existence from Mahayana point of view, Mahayana Abhidharma point of view. This is a view that takes as its referent, remember the difference between referent and aspect, takes as its referent the contaminated aggregates, my own contaminated aggregates. What are those? My socks? My pens? No, my body and the four mental aggregates, right? Feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. So it views the contaminated aggregates as in various levels of sophistication, either a permanent, partless, independent self, or a self-supporting, substantially existent self, or from the Mahayana point of view, an inherently existent self. So it's called a view of the transitory collection because it's viewing the body and mind, and it's somehow coming to the conclusion that somehow here is a real self based on this. Now there's much, much subtlety to this, much more subtlety to this, especially when we talk about it in the Majjhimaka, from the Majjhimaka point of view. Because from the Majjhimaka point of view, you're not observing the aggregates. Oh, maybe you remember when we talked about in Lorig, we said that from the Sautrantika point of view, some of you remember that name, Sautrantika point of view, when you realize selflessness, you observed the aggregates, the contaminated aggregates, and you recognized, you had a realization of their impermanence. Indirectly, sort of like, it's not appearing to your mind, but indirectly you realize the lack of a permanent self, permanent, partless, independent self. Because you're seeing that it's impermanent, indirectly you know that it can't be permanent. In the same way that I mentioned to you here, you see that there's no... If I ask you, is there an elephant in the room, and you look around, you know, you see there's no elephant, indirectly you realize the non-existence of elephant. You're not actually seeing the non-existence of elephant. A little bit tricky. You might say you are, because the non-existence of elephant is just a mental construct. It's a permanent phenomenon, the non-existence of elephant. Same thing here. The non-existence of the self, the shunya, the voidness of a self, is an intellectually created form, is an entity. It's something which is permanent. So from the Sautrantika point of view, you actually are observing the transitory aggregates. That's why it's called the view of the transitory collection. Why is it called collection? Because this is a collection of parts, right? The body, the mind, the feelings, compositional factors. So from the Sautrantika point of view, you're observing those. There is a view of that in conceiving it to be, let's say, a self-sufficient person. From the Prasangika point of view, the referent object is not the contaminated aggregates. That's not what you're looking at. What are you looking at? Do you know? Do you remember? Mind? No? Has anyone hadn't studied before? You're the oldest student here. You have to answer. No? Not joy, you. So what's the referent object of the view of the transitory collection for Prasangika Majjhimika? I. Okay, good. This I, not this I, right? Capital, this I. So it's very subtle. The referent object is the self. And the aspect that the view of the transitory collection views the self is as an independent, let's say, an inherently existent self, existing there from its own side. Like when we do Mahamudra meditation, when we try to calm the mind in our meditation, and at the end try to watch how the I appears within that calmness of the mind. Remember our meditation at the beginning? That I seems, the self, it's not going to appear right away, just one sitting right now. You have to do again and again, quiet the mind, instigate the sense of self a little bit, notice how it's there. It seems to be inherently existent. So the view of the transitory collection is that ignorance that's grasping to it, the conceived object. There is an appearance of the I to your mind. That does exist. But what we think that appearance is, that's called the conceived object. You know, our mind is, like say for instance, the rabbit, whose little ears come up in the morning, you're looking outside and you see, oh, a rabbit has horns. You actually are seeing something that maybe looks a little bit like horns, but you're conceiving, you're thinking there really are horns on this rabbit. And Theravada, did you ever use that example, the horns of a rabbit? Have you ever heard that example being given for something that doesn't exist? The horns of a rabbit. Do you know what a rabbit is, this little animal? I don't know how you say it. Has ears, long ears. Kids love bunnies, bunny rabbits. Yeah. Do they? Maybe this is not an example that's given in the Theravada tradition. Is it? Okay. A deer is deer. Deer does have horns, but a rabbit doesn't have horns. So, yeah. So this view of the transitory collection is that which we're trying to observe as what is holding or adhering to this self in the Mahamudra meditation. Okay. So now, having introduced that, go back to pride. Remember we said attachment, anger, third one, pride. Pride depends on the view of the transitory collection as a real I. So it's taking that as a basis, a given.
Yeah.
I. And has the aspect of puffing up the mind upon observing one's own wealth, wealth, qualities, you might intelligence and good looks, whatever, youth, and so forth. So it's a sort of when you blow up a balloon, what do you call that? It's, sort of like puffing up or blowing up your qualities, expanding. It's exaggerating on the basis of the view of the transitory collection. In other words, on the basis of this strong belief that there really is an I, and I am wealthy, you know, I am a Chernoff. That's my family's name, right? Chernoff. Or I am a Rothschild, or I am a Rockefeller. What's a famous name here in Singapore? Lee. I am a Lee. You know, so somehow I'm superior, right? And I'm not criticizing, if anyone's listening. I'm not criticizing the government. I'm just giving example early, not criticizing. So, but pride is this. Can you imagine that? You know, there are people, have you met people that are proud of their family heritage? Or proud of being Italian, or proud of being German, or whatever, you know? Proud of being, of having qualities like intelligence, or, you know, looking down at others, oh, they, you know. And also because of wealth, looking down upon others, because of your pride and your wealth, looking down upon others who don't have the wealth. Do you remember what Marie Antoinette was supposedly had said when she was told of the famine? Remember Marie Antoinette? Was she the wife of one of the French kings, right? What did she say? You know? Behind it, yeah, this lady, do you know what she said? Yeah. Yeah. Let them eat cake. Yes. They don't have bread? Let them eat cake. So what is that? So there's some incredible pride, right? Because to her, cake is always there, very wealthy. Poor people didn't have bread. What's the problem? Let them eat cake. That happened just recently in the United States. One of the ministers in the Trump administration, he was told that the people that they had a shutdown of the government in the United States for like almost a month, I think, or just over a month, and a lot of the workers didn't get paid. And some of them were going for free food, like the food bank or something like that, where they could get donations. And he said, why are they doing that? They should just go get a loan, sell one of their paintings. Sell one of it. Poor people, maybe they don't have a painting that's worth anything, you know. You know, so it's a little bit like Marie Antoinette. So because of that pride. So pride depends on the view of the transitory collection as a real I, and has the aspect of puffing up of the mind upon observing one's own wealth, qualities, youth, and so forth. Many times when we're young, or you might see kids sometimes making fun of old people. It's very dissettling to me, because those kids will also grow old. You know, they just don't. You know, now they think they're young, and this old person is walking slowly with cane or something. It has the function of serving as a basis for the arising of disrespect and suffering. Okay, and they give different divisions of pride. I'll just mention one or two of them. There's seven famous ones that Nagarjuna mentioned in his letter to a king and also from the sutras. So there's regular pride, a puffing up of the mind, thinking that one is superior to lower people. Excessive pride, puffing up of the mind, thinking that one is superior to one's equals, one's peers, you know. You can imagine the pride that thinks you're superior to those that are lower than you, like the someone who's begging on the street, is homeless and destitute. Instead of having compassion, there are some people who disdain them out of pride. I'm better than that person. But there's a further kind of pride when you feel superior even to those who are equal to you, your colleagues, so to speak. You're always finding some way to put yourself up a little bit higher. Then there is pride beyond pride, a puffing up of the mind thinking that one is greatly superior even to persons who are superior to others. Or like say, or superior to you. So even to your gurus, you are superior. Actually, okay, they know something. Buddha knew something, but actually, I know a lot too. I know maybe more. You know, sort of extensive kind of pride. One of the prides is called pride of slight inferiority. How would that work? Pride of slight inferiority. A puffing up of the mind, thinking that one is just a little lower than others who are actually greatly superior. Again, maybe with respect to your Dharma friends or the gurus or the Buddha, thinking, okay, they're a little bit better than me. In other words, actually not recognizing that you are really just a beginner and putting yourself almost on that level, still accepting them as a little bit superior. Because pride causes disrespect for high qualities, and for those who possess high qualities, that is, others' high qualities, it serves to obstruct new attainment of doctrines. There's a Tibetan expression. In the spring, the early spring, the first grass grows in the valley. As the summer progresses, the grass begins to grow along the sides of the mountains. But even at the height of summer, it never grows on the snowy peaks, the rocky peaks of the mountains way up. So they say that realizations first grow within the mind which is humble, which is lacking pride. Right? Pride is a great obstacle to making spiritual realizations, because you hear something and you might think, oh, I heard that before, you know, or I know that. When you put yourself low, consider yourself the lowest, whatever you hear, even from your companions, or even those that you that might otherwise be considered lower than you, someone says to you, oh, you're cheap. That's a way, in English, that means like you're miserly. I don't know if you use it like, oh, you're miserly. You didn't give me any money. We might disregard that. Someone with a humble mind might think, yes, okay, this is right. So to try to remedy that, to hear everything as a teaching. Atisha said in his Bodhisattva, the Rosary of the Bodhisattva Practices. I'm not sure where he wrote. He might have written in Jambi. I don't know. He certainly, all of those Atisha's teachings, something happened, light went out. So, can you still hear me? Yeah. In that he said, you should see those who are superior to you as your teacher. You should see those who are equal to you as your teacher. You should see those who are lower than you as your teacher. So just the opposite of pride. So in the mind that has a lot of pride, like the Rocky Mountain, you know, the up along the sides of the hills, what do we say? Usually say along the mountains there's a certain point they call the tree line where there's no longer any trees beyond that. Do you have maybe you don't have high enough mountain here in Singapore for that, but you know what I'm talking about, right? So up there, no grass grows. So realizations are very difficult to be generated in a mind with great pride. Okay. So what have we got so far? We've got attachment, anger, pride, right? Then ignorance. Ignorance here. There are two kinds of ignorance I mentioned before. One is this ignorance. Ignorance is an absence of knowledge that involves obscuration with respect to the status of phenomena. It just doesn't know. It has this function of serving as a basis for the arisal of false certainty, for the arisal of doubt, and the arisal of afflictions. Its principal antidote is the wisdom cognizing selflessness. So this is talking about the lesser of the two ignorances. One of the ignorance is simply not knowing. Like say, not knowing the law of cause and effect, not knowing that there's no self, but not actually realizing it. The more destructive, more subtle kind of ignorance is actually a distorted wisdom that perceives, like this one that we call the view of the transitory collection. That's the fundamental kind of ignorance. It perceives something and believes it to be true, certain. It's not just a state of not knowing something. It's a state of discrimination, so it's a kind of wisdom, but it's a state of discrimination that has erroneously discriminated this appearance of an I as really being there. That's the more potent, that's the more dangerous of the two kinds of ignorance. One is simply not knowing. Like you say, I'm ignorant. I don't know anything, or someone is ignorant. But this, the real meaning of ignorance from the Buddhist perspective is a more subtle one. It's actually an active, proactive consciousness that's misperceiving reality. Okay. So we could say in Nargarjuna's writings, one of you back there knew this question about before when I said what was the referent object of the view of the transitory collection. So here's also a question for you. In Nargarjuna's writings, what does he say the root of samsara is? Do you remember? Or maybe this is not something you know. There's a difference between Nargarjuna and Chandrakirti. They were both considered to be great explainers of the Majjhimika philosophy, the Prasangika philosophy. So from Nargarjuna's point of view in his writings, he said, the root of samsara is ignorance, this mental factor, this klesha. Chandrakirti said it was the view of the transitory collection. So in the end, if you analyze that, which division is bigger? The ignorance in general or the view of the transitory collection? Like if you have sets. Actually, the view of the transitory collection is a type of ignorance. It's the main one. There are other kinds of ignorance. So both were right. Nargarjuna and Chandrakirti were both right, but they're just putting emphasis on different things. The view of the transitory collection, okay, here's the difference. The general ignorance that Nargarjuna was talking about includes not just the view of the selflessness of yourself, it includes this ignorance includes grasping to a self of other people besides yourself and grasping at the self of phenomena. Whereas Chandrakirti said it was just the view of the transitory collection. So what is it? What does the view of the transitory collection take as its object? The selves of all people? No. Just one's own self, right? Just views one's own self. Generally, when we talk about selflessness of persons, we say there's a selflessness of my own continuum, my own self, and this selflessness of other persons. Generally, when we say persons, includes all persons. But when you talk about the selflessness of phenomena, in that distinction, selves and persons and phenomena, their phenomena includes all the other things besides persons, our bodies, our form aggregates, our feelings, and so forth. The outer phenomena, the cars, the buildings, the trees, the bunny rabbits. All of these things are empty of existing inherently. So Nargarjuna said, that's the root of cyclic existence. Ignorance that includes not just the selflessness of the person. It does include that, but in addition to that, the selflessness of others, the selflessness of all phenomena. Whereas Chandrakirti said the root of cyclic existence is the view of the transitory collection, which is just a subset of that ignorance. Do you know what I mean by subset? just like a, you know, if you enumerate all the different kinds of ignorance, the ignorance of other phenomena, the ignorance of other persons, the ignorance of the self, the view of the transitory collection is just the ignorance about one's own self, grasping to that. Okay. So was Nagarjuna right, Chandrakirti was wrong? Seems like different positions, right? Yeah, what is it? Yeah, turn that microphone on.
Same view. Both are correct.
Both are correct, yeah. Okay. Easy to say.
Because both...
Good. You're giving a reason, okay.
Chandrakirti says that it grabs to the I as an inner assistant. This is the root of samsara. More apprehension is the same.
Good. So, remember we said the referent object of the view of the transitory collection from the Prajnagika point of view is the self.
Yeah.
But the aspect is holding it to be inherently existent.
Yes.
That's the same aspect that the ignorance holds all these other phenomena.
Yes.
So if you know the, Chandrakirti's point was, if you can get rid of this ignorance that's grasping at the self as inherently existent, you will also know the non-inherent existence of all phenomena, because there's no difference in the subtlety.
Yeah.
And there's some sense to say, you know, you can still argue about that, you know, oh, Nagarjuna is correct and Chandrakirti is wrong. But still, when you realize, when you first have an experience of shunyata, of emptiness, the wisdom that realizes emptiness, you know, you've recognized, generally, the first real experience is with respect to the personal I, your own, the emptiness of the self. Although you might have been introduced first about the emptiness of other phenomena, when it comes down to the taste, the first experience of that that goes, you know, changes your life, that usually is with respect to personal selflessness. So Chandrakirti was emphasizing that point, because that's the initial. From that, then you can expand that understanding of non-inherent existence to other phenomena. So it's a very interesting point. Okay, so then, what have we got so far? We had attachment, anger, pride. What was it? Ignorance. Now doubt, afflicted doubt. So there are some doubts that are not afflicted doubt. Remember when we talked about doubt, or what did we call it in the Lodic? What was another name? Indecisive wavering, or what else? So it's a mind which is two-pointed. Here, doubt is a two-pointedness of mind with respect to things that are true. The Four Noble Truths, actions and their effects, karma and their results, and so forth. It has the function of serving as a basis for non-engagement in virtues. Doubt obstructs all virtuous activities, especially interferes with seeing the truth. So you might feel depressed, because you might think, I still have doubt about reincarnation or karma. I don't have just one-pointed confidence that this is true. But as the great saint said, I think even Nagarjuna said, doubt is not a big problem as long as you work to alleviate it. Because that can, as you still have doubt, if you understand, you need to eliminate that doubt, otherwise it will prevent you from engaging. If you always say, should I do it? Should I not? Should I do it? What was that famous thing? Does she love me? What were they thinking? There's some in, was it Shakespeare? No, not Shakespeare. There's a flower, so that people, how's it go? Rose, you're taking off the petals to find out whether your friend loves you or not. You like a divination. You say, she loves me, she loves me not. You know, you don't know whether you should go and marry her or whatever. She loves me not. She loves me, the last leaf. You know, you know. So there's doubt. There's a two-pointed mind. Does she love me or does she not love me? You're depending upon someone else to you know, the flower to give you some answer. You know. That's not from Shakespeare, is it? No. Okay, you're no Shakespeare scholars here. Okay. So doubt is a two-pointedness of mind that prevents you from engaging in virtue. Here it's not that's not an example of this doubt. That's you know, doubting whether someone loves you or not is not preventing you from engaging in virtue. Doubt obstructs all virtuous activities and especially interferes with seeing the truth. So, as Nagarjuna said, doubt is, although it's a problem and prevents you, it can be overcome as long as you seek to decide which it is. Should I become a Buddhist? Should I practice this path? Or should I not? You know, different. You know, if I become Buddhist, I have to give up killing. You know, I might like to go fishing or hunting. But then again, if I give up, there's these good qualities. You just can't decide. Right? So if you can alleviate the doubt, then you can make very rapid progress. So it has that virtue. Okay, so that's five. Those are called the five non-view, the five afflictions that are not views. The sixth affliction is called afflicted views or deluded views. And this has five varieties. The first of which is the one we just talked about, the view of the transitory collection. The view of the transitory collection observes the appropriated mental and physical aggregates, contaminated, appropriated physical aggregates. Why are they called appropriated aggregates? Do you know? I can't remember the Sanskrit name for that, what that means. I know the Tibetan, but I can't remember the Sanskrit. It means we appropriate. What does it mean to appropriate something? Like the government has appropriated the property of the corporation. The corporation went bankrupt and now the government is appropriated. It means taken over to make one's own when you appropriate something. Is that a word you're familiar with? Appropriation? Is that something? Maybe there's another word that can be used, but that's what's used here. The appropriated aggregates means in the bardo state, in the intermediate state before taking rebirth, there's a fertilized egg, the fertilized ovum in mother's womb. Let's say if you're going to be born as a human, you could be born also from a kind of, you can be born from an egg, in which case there's also, like in a chicken, or you can be born from heat. Do you know what that means, born from heat? Do you know, Venerable? When you talk about the different forms of birth, you can be born from womb, egg, heat, or miraculously. So maybe you want to say, so this refers to sometimes at a certain point in the summer, or say you just have your banana peels on the, you know, you haven't thrown them out yet, and they're sitting there in the warm house, and after a couple of days some flies appear. There were no flies in your house before. Where did those flies come from? It said in the scriptures, they arise from heat. I think what that means is this. I may be wrong, but when I've checked about this, my own thinking, could be wrong, is that there's still a kind of egg. There's some kind of, you know, something that was laid on these banana peels or whatever it is. But the consciousness does not enter into those eggs at the same time as, say, a chicken egg when it's fertilized. If it's going to give rise to a baby chicken, a consciousness in the intermediate state enters into that at that time, and then it grows. You can't just keep that egg on your shelf for many months, and then later, after 2 months, a consciousness enters into it, and then it comes a chicken, right? It has to be very close to the time of when the egg and ovum meet. Whereas in the case of birth by heat, I think there's some kind of eggs that are produced, and then later when heat is a cooperative condition, like in the summer or the heat of your apartment, sort of causes that to be ripened, a consciousness from the intermediate state can enter into that. When you think of all the flies, we call in English we call mayflies in the summer, well, in May, the month of May, so many of these little teeny flies, each one of those is a sentient being. Each one of them has been born, usually from heat, something like that. Then the fourth kind of birth is miraculous birth, just arising, like supposedly Guru Padmasambhava, miraculous birth, you know, in the middle of a lotus. There are stories in the Buddhist sutras at the early time of the evolution of the universe when some humans were born from eggs, some humans were born miraculously, the kings and so forth. So in the intermediate state, when you're about to take rebirth, let's say into a fertilized ovum in mother's womb, before you enter into that, that's something foreign, different than you, right? But entering into it with the thought, I'm going to take birth there, or with a somehow karmic wind forcing you there, you appropriate that to be your own. So then, that physical aggregate and the gross minds that expand from your mind, the Bardo intermediate state mind, those are called appropriated aggregates, because it wasn't yours from the beginning. You kind of took it over, like you, in the past, when a king would, ancient times, a king would put taxes on people if they couldn't pay, he would appropriate their property. Okay, I'm taking your children, I'm taking your wife, you know, appropriate all the property and the cattle and everything. So a view of the transitory collection observes the appropriated mental and physical aggregates. Previously it said the contaminated, sometimes both words are there, the contaminated, appropriated aggregates, and conceives them to be a real I and mine, M-I-N-E. So this is a subtle distinction. The view of the transitory collection, this kind of basic ignorance that, as was pointed out, that conceives the self to be inherently existent, it also has another function. It conceives the mine to be inherently existent. So what is mine? Interesting. What's an example of mine? Do you know? So you know the feeling of I, right? What is the state of mind that thinks mine? Well, my body. If you were to ask for an illustration of mine, you might say, my body, my feelings. You've hurt my feelings. Huh. You might be proud of my intelligence. You know, something that's an illustration of what is mine. But those are not actually mine. Cece, you know what I'm talking about? You've heard before? You studied this? So, I, the sense of I, appears within the mental consciousness. And the belief in that, the view of the transitory collection that views the appearance of the I as real, not just in appearance, but as real, that's the view of the transitory collection as a real I. But there's also a state of mind within your mind that thinks, mine. It's not referring to the object, like the body, but when you think, my body, there is a state of mind within your consciousness that's thinking, mine. the same way that there's or the appearance of that, you know, as though there was a real possessor of the qualities, mine, in the same way there appears to be a real I here. So that's what's being referred to. In a more simplistic presentation, one would actually say it views the I and mine, my possessions. But that's, from the Prasangika point of view, that's not the final view. These things may be illustrations of mine. Illustrations, you might think, well, doesn't that mean that that's mine? That's an illustration of mine is something that my the concept of my is holding on to as mine. So this mug, you might say, or my cell phone, or, you know, those are illustrations of what could be considered mine, but the state of mind, the subject that's holding them to be mine, is what is being referred to here as mine. Does that make sense? Okay. Oh, good. Yeah. It is, so we're talking of the view of the transitory connection. It is an endurance. You know what endurance means? Some kind of inertia, continuation, in the sense of not fearing the mistakenness of inherently existent I and mine. So the view of the transitory collection is kind of like some kind of confidence in this, that there really are an inherently existent I and mine. It is a desire, the view of the transitory collection. So in that sense, it's analogous to the tanha, or in Sanskrit, trisna, which is the main thrust in the Theravada tradition when we talk about what's the root of samsara. That's the one that especially is present all the time, but is especially nefarious, especially bad at the time of death, because that's what's ripening, the thirst or craving, grasping, becoming. That's what causes us to continue. So here, this one is also like a desire, the view of the transitory collection. It's a desire in the sense of seeking a mistaken object. Because desire is seeking, attachment is seeking something, right? It's exaggerated the qualities. Like, say, at the time of death, the example that I gave before, I think I read in some example that perhaps Alex Berzin thought up, or maybe he heard from his teachers, like a rat, mouse, a big rat, drowning and grasping onto anything, thirsting for life, wanting to get continuing life, anything. So at the time of death, the mind is grasping out to anything to not to lose the continuity of life. So this view of the transitory collection is an intelligence. Remember I said that ignorance is a distorted intelligence or distorted wisdom? It is an intelligence or wisdom in the sense of thoroughly discriminating its object. Because wisdom, when we talk about the wisdom, prajna, how do we say in Pali? Prajna. Panya. Panya. Again, PR, shortened to just... So, when I studied a little bit Pali in Delhi University, it was a very good... there's a book, if you're ever interested, there's a whole study of this, how the evolution of how Pali was... There's actually almost some rules, you know, how you can derive Pali from the Sanskrit words. This is a very particular rules. So it is a panya or a prajna in the sense of thoroughly discriminating its object. Not all prajna, wisdom, is virtuous. If we talk about the prajna paramita, perfection of wisdom, when we say someone has wisdom, usually we're referring to the positive. But among the 51 mental factors, is prajna found in the 11 virtuous mental factors? No, it wasn't there. Where was it found? In the object ascertaining mental factors. So you could have a bad, misdirected wisdom, you know, thinking, how can I make a better bomb? How can I cheat people out of their money or something like that? Okay. So the view of the transitory collection is also a conceptual mind. It's a conception in the sense of adhering strongly to its object. So what is its object? Is its object the appearance of the eye? That's not its main object. That's its appearing object. It's the main object is its conceived object, what he believes this to be. Like in a mirage or a rainbow, they say a mirage. You see a mirage, and if I told you the mirage doesn't exist, what would you say? Ah, the mirage exists. You can see it, right? But does it exist the way that it appears? What does it appear as? As water. At least that's the conceived object there. The object that's appearing is some kind of distortion, maybe wavering light that we associate with water. So what you conceive or think is there, the thought about object, the believed object, the conceived object is water. Here, what's appearing in your mind is the appearance of an eye, which you can't deny, like the mirage, like a rainbow, like a reflection, something is appearing, but it's devoid of the quality that the mind thinks is there, conceives is there. It's devoid of the conceived object of the eye. A view of the transitory collection has the function of serving as a basis for all bad views, and especially also serves as a basis for pride, we saw. Especially, the stronger your ego. We could say the view of the transitory collection is what we would say if someone has big ego. Do you use that expression here in Singapore? He has a big ego, or is that... Yeah, you know what I mean. Someone who has a big ego is susceptible to pride, but the having a big ego means that view of the transitory collection is really believing there really is a real I here. So that's the thing that has to be protected at all cost. It is called the view of the transitory collection because the mental and physical aggregates, which are the base of this view, at least in the lesser view of things, remember the higher point of view, what is actually being observed is not the transitory collection of body and mind, it's actually the self. But the self is labeled on the transitory collection. Okay, enough of that. So then another view. So there are five views, five afflicted views. Second one here is called the view, or extreme view, or view holding to extreme. What is that? A view holding to an extreme observes the self as apprehended by the view of the transitory collection. Remember it said it was the basis for all, the view of the transitory collection was the basis for all the bad views, all the wrong views. So view holding extreme observes the self as apprehended by the view of the transitory collection and conceives it to be either permanent in the sense of unchanging or annihilated in the sense of not transmigrating to another lifetime. So there were, I think, 14 unanswered questions. Do you have in Theravada tradition also, when Buddha was asked by some non-Buddhist, when the Tathagata dies, does he take rebirth or does he disappear? Is he annihilated? And the Buddha, there are 14 famous questions like this. The Buddha remained silent. So some Western scholars, they said, oh, see, the Buddha didn't know everything. He didn't know the answer to these 14 questions. But he's completely mistaken. Here, the people who asked these questions were holding to extreme views. They were viewing, because of belief in an inherently existent self, their thought was that the self remains unchanged and continues on into the future. You know, sort of a Vedic idea, pre the religion before Buddha came, that the soul or the Atma continues on permanently, unchanging. Or they were saying either that, there's only from their point of view, if this self really looks to be there, either it's going to continue on like that into the future, or at the time of death, it's going to be cut off and disappear completely, no self whatsoever. Okay? So the Buddha didn't answer them because they were not an appropriate vessel to receive the nectar of the teachings. They would have to be first, their minds would have to be first inculcated, you know, taught other things about impermanence and so forth. So that's a view of an extreme. Another of the, so view of the transitory collection, view of the extreme, then there is the view, a conception of these bad views as supreme. What that means is exception of these deluded views to be supreme observes a view of the transitory collection, again, a view holding to extreme, the second one, a perverse view, which we didn't talk about yet, or the mental and physical aggregates in dependence upon which these views arise, and conceive such to be supreme in the sense of claiming it to be perfect. Sort of like it's like a view which, you know, if you're holding this I to be truly existent, sort of thinking, yes, this is not only true, this is the best view. I'll leave it at that. There's a view of the supreme. One of the other ones is view of bad ethics and modes of conduct as supreme. Usually we talk about this also in the Theravada. So this is a conception of bad ethics and modes of conduct to be supreme. That takes as its object a faulty system of ethics that is intended to abandon faulty ethics. A faulty system of ethics, like say for instance, some of the Hindu Vedic systems believe that if you were to stand on one leg. Do they have in Sri Lanka like this? I believe the sadhus, for years they stand on one leg, thinking that kind. They think that's a kind of ethical behavior. It's not good ethics. They believe that by doing so you may achieve moksha. Usually they don't use the word nirvana in the Hindu tradition, right? They use moksha. Moksha, synonym from Buddhist point of view, also means nirvana. But remember, I'm not saying mokha. I just remind you. Mokha is a kind of chocolate coffee mixture. They may have misunderstood when I say moksha. They might have thought, oh, I could do with a mokha right now, a mokha latte. So conception of bad ethics and modes of conduct are supreme. Also, what else do they do? They sit within, what do they say, the nine fires. They'll have fires in the four cardinal directions around them, so they're very hot. And then in the sub-directions, so there's eight. And then at the, maybe they say ten, maybe there's something underneath them also, but like the sun above. And they think that by enduring this, they feel this is the best ethics because this will burn up all their karma. They'll attain moksha like this. So, So there's a lot we could say about that, but we've got little time. Then the last of the five views is called wrong view or perverse view. Remember we said there were six root delusions. Five of them are non-views. What were they? Attachment, anger, and so forth. Then the sixth one, afflicted views. If we divided that up, it has five kinds. View of the transitory collection. What was it? Extreme view. No, this is the, yeah. Yeah, view of the extreme. What else? View holding extreme, view of bad, the view that conceives, like say, the view of the transitory collection is supreme, you know, then this conception of bad ethics and modes of conduct is supreme, and then finally, the fifth one is called wrong view, Tibetan called lokta, perverse view or wrong view. What is that? That's the one that we often we call that whole group sometimes wrong view. A perverse view or wrong view is a denial of cause, effect, functionality, and existence, an existent phenomena, and can involve holding such things as Ishvara, you know, one of the Hindu gods, and so forth, are the cause of beings migrating in cyclic existence. You know, some people believe why we take rebirth. Some Hindus believe that in reincarnation. Some believe it's because of karma. Some believe it's because of Ishvara, one of the gods, sort of puts you in the right place or something like that. These are called wrong views. Denial of cause is a view that good and bad behavior and so forth do not exist. So wrong view. So for instance, there were some, in the time of the Buddha, there were some people who wanted to have, maybe nowadays they'd be called a pedophile or something. They wanted to have sex with a young girl. And so they made up rules that was good. They even believed, wrong view, that was good. And they're probably some of the people, the people who do these crimes today, even, they have that kind of wrong view. Something, thinking that it's okay to do this. That would be an example of this perverse view, wrong view. So that's an example of denial of cause, that good and bad behavior and so forth do not exist. You know, everything's okay, it doesn't matter what you do. Denial of effect is a view that the ripening of virtuous and non-virtuous actions does not exist. You know, there's no, you know, karma doesn't ripen like this. Denial of functionality is a view that former and latter lives and so forth do not exist. So perverse views or wrong views have the function of severing virtuous roots. When we talk about, you know, one of the most destructive ways to destroy virtuous karma, we say roots of virtue, is by getting angry. But there are other ways also. Abandoning the Dharma is one, and one is holding wrong views. So holding wrong views also is said to sever the roots of virtue. What does that mean, roots of virtue? It's not talking about the mental, well, it could be the continuum of your virtuous states of mind, but it also means that it eliminates the root, these karmic seeds in your consciousness to have these. So there are 20 secondary minds that I'm not going to go through. We don't have time. We just have a couple minutes. And just so that would make, what do we talk about? 5 omnipresent mental factors, 5 object ascertaining make 10, right? 11 virtuous mental factors makes what? 21. 6 root delusions? 27. 20 secondary mental factors? 47. Right? 27 and 20 is 47, right? Then there are 4 changeable mental factors. So 47 and 4 makes what? 51. So these are changeable mental factors, are sleep. Actually, here we're not talking about just, you know, I'm going to sleep. It's a particular mental factor that causes the senses to withdraw away from their sense bases and to be left in a foggy state, you know, a state of sleep. Sleep is a powerless withdrawal inside of the engagement by sense consciousness in objects. It depends on causes such as heaviness of body, you know, eating, late at night and weakness, fatigue, taking the figure of darkness to mind and so forth. Yeah, just thinking of darkness can induce sleep also. Sleep involves ignorance and has the function of serving as a basis for losing virtuous activities. But sleep itself is a changeable mental factor. It's not virtuous by nature. It's not non-virtuous. It depends on what precedes the sleep. If you go to sleep, before you go to sleep, you try to have a virtuous motivation, that whole period of sleep can be creating virtuous karma. If you go to sleep kind of bummed out, you know, kind of like depressed or angry, the whole sleep, even though you're not thinking negative thoughts during the whole sleep can become negative, creating negative karma. So it's very good before you go to sleep to try to have a good state of mind. Another changeable mental factor is regret or contrition. It can either be positive or negative. For instance, if you regret doing virtuous actions, you've given the beggar some money, you go into Starbucks, you don't have enough to buy your coffee, and you say, why did I give that person the money? You regret giving the money. That creates negative karma. That's a negative regret. If, on the other hand, you think of the negative actions you've done and you thought, I shouldn't have done that. You know, I've created karmic imprints that will harm myself, prevent making realizations, and have harmed others. If you feel that kind of regret, that kind of regret is a positive regret, virtuous regret. And then the last two of the 51 are two kinds of a mind that checks. One is called, it's grosser, it's called investigation. The more subtle one is called analysis. Investigation, let me see what he says here. Investigation and analysis. Investigation is an inquiry into the rough realities, the rough entities of objects, as well as their names, whereas analysis is a fine discrimination of these. So these states of mind, you can use investigation and analysis to investigate and analyze how to make a bomb or how to cheat people and so forth, or you could use them to analyze selflessness and so forth. Okay, so in this little mini course on mind and mental factors, we've been this last four classes, we've been talking about these mental factors. The only one we didn't go to in a little detail was the 20 secondary mental factors, the secondary delusions, afflictions. So let's try to dedicate the merits at the end. Different than in, I think, Chinese Mahayana, where they talk about, what was that lady saying the other day? Sharing, or what was it? Transferring. Yeah, from Mahayana point of view, in the general Mahayana tradition, maybe Chinese Buddhism is considered Mahayana. Generally, we don't talk about transferring or sharing your merits. The merits, the virtuous karma you create, can only ripen on your own continuum. But we dedicate them in such a way that, in whatever way these virtuous karmas ripen, maybe they become the cause of my continued spiritual development, continually being able to be less harmful to others as my mind becomes more calm, and not only non-harmful, to actually benefit sentient beings. We can imagine that this lifetime, and in the future, as this karma continues to ripen, may it always ripen in a way that whatever, you know, pleasant experience I encounter due to the ripening of this within cyclic existence, may I always use it to enhance my spiritual practice and to benefit sentient beings. Due to this merit, may I quickly become a Buddha, an enlightened being, for the sake of all sentient beings. So like the reins of a horse can turn the horse away from just the way it wants to go to eat the clover in its favorite place or to lick the salt block somewhere else. You can control it. Here we can, through this kind of aspiration, this prayer or dedication, you can urge or turn the karma to ripen in this particular way. So it doesn't just ripen in some short-lived samsaric happiness in the future, but it always acts to fuel one's spiritual development and enhancing your empathy for others. You're using whatever occurs, if you're wealthy, to use it for others, and so forth. Thank you very much. So we have a break of a couple of maybe 8 days, and then if you're game, I think there's a couple of lectures on karma, which I would recommend, you know, especially if you know someone. It's only going to be 2 days, I think, right? The karma. So that might be something that some people that you know might profit from. So if you can get someone to come along. And then also I'll be finishing a couple of more days on the four tenets. And what is the other one? There's one other class. Anyway, something else is coming up. Thank you very much. Have a good evening. Thank you.